Hello from Duluth, Minnesota. Okay, actually, I'm not in Duluth. Obviously, I'm sitting here in my office. It's Friday afternoon. We're about to leave. By the time you're seeing this, I will be in Duluth, however, along with some of the students from our youth group and Joe and Shelley Stafke and I, and we'll be attending District Blitz, which I'm anticipating is going to be a great event and life-transforming, I hope, for our kids, at least life-impacting for these students. So thanks for your prayers. We'll be in our final session when you are seeing this. On to our sermon for today. Usually when I am gone, we have a live preacher for you. But as I've told you in the past, once per year, though, I am going to bring a sermon to you, a video sermon to you. And it's always going to be from a preacher who has begun to be known as one of the top evangelical preachers in our nation. Even though I totally agree that it's just weird to watch a video sermon in church together, I do see value in us collectively as a church hearing from some of these people and getting exposed to some of their teaching. So I do think that some of the video sermons we've watched in the past have been memorable. So now on to 2016. So barring an emergency, this will be our only video sermon of the year. And I'm excited about this one. Speaking for you today is going to be Pastor John Ortberg. John Ortberg is senior pastor of Menlo Park Presbyterian Church in San Mateo, California. Let's see, they have about 3,325 more members than we do. Pastor Ortberg actually led this church through a split or through a breakaway from the main Presbyterian church because of some feelings that that denomination was moving away from traditional teachings of the church and away from biblical teachings. And instead, they have joined an organization called ECO, which is a Covenant Order of Evangelical Presbyterians. He's written a number of books. He's on the Board of Trustees for Fuller Seminary and the board for the Dallas Willard Center for Spiritual Formation. This sermon was actually recorded when he was the guest speaker at Bill Hybels Church at Willow Creek. Well, let's dive into it. Let's get started. I do really believe that you're going to benefit from John Ortberg's teaching today. So God bless you.
If somebody were to ask you, what's the most treasured possession that you own, what would you say? Because we all have like an object or something that we treasure above everything else. And the way you can often tell is if it's ever damaged or threatened, you kind of go ballistic. Like, I'm not a car guy. I drive an old Honda Accord. It has been dinged up so much, I don't even notice when it gets new dings. But I was backing out of a real crowded parking lot not long ago, and I heard a metal scrape. And it wasn't real loud. I hoped it was nothing, but I got out and looked at the car next to me, and there was a little scratch on it. It wasn't a crumple. It wasn't a ding. It was just a little line. It was almost decorative. But it wasn't my car, somebody else's car, and it wasn't a beater car. It was an Italian car. Its name rhymes with Ferrari. And so I left a note on the car, and day later, the owner called me up, said, appreciate the note. He said, I just need you to know that I got to have this car in original mint condition because this car is my baby. I said, okay. He called me back the next day. He said, I just need you to know I've taken it to the shop. This defect cannot be buffed out. The whole panel must be replaced. I said, okay. He called me back the next day. He said, I found out it can't be done by a local body shop. It must go to the dealer in Italy. I said, okay. He called me back the next day. It's a true story. And he said, this whole thing has upset me so much, I'm just going to have the entire car replaced so you don't owe me anything at all. And I said, if you're not going to use the old car anymore. That car was his treasure, and so he became a student of it. He understood it, and he cared for it deeply, and we're all like that. Might be a relationship, might be a job or something, but we all have something that we treasure. And of course, the Bible says, be real careful about, you know, don't put your treasure where moth and rust can corrode, and so. And it often uses a little word to talk about what you ought to treasure most that we're going to talk about for these moments right now. When Moses was going to leave the Israelites, kind of his parting words were, only be careful and watch over your souls closely. writer of Hebrews says that a soul is such a valuable thing that watching over souls is actually the primary task of the church. Think about this. Writer says, have confidence in your leaders and be responsive to their counsel. They keep watch over your souls as people who must give account. This idea runs all the way through the Bible, but its classic expression was given by Jesus, who said once, what good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet lose their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? Jesus, the master of life, says, you have a soul, whatever that is. We'll come back to that. He says, you can take all the money, all the power, all the status, all the reputation, all the fame, all the pleasure of the earth on one side, and your little soul on the other side. And if you get all that and lose that, whatever it means to lose your soul, we'll come back to that, you've made a bad deal. Now, why is your soul of immense worth? Why does it matter so much? I'm going to give you a quote from a guy, Dallas Willard, and I'm super indebted to him for what we're going to talk about in this message. Dallas said, what is running your life at any given moment is your soul. Not external circumstances or your thoughts or your intentions or even your feelings, but your soul. And then he gets into what the soul is. Your soul is that aspect of your whole being that integrates and enlivens everything going on in what he calls the various dimensions of the self. The soul is the life center of human beings. Now, of course, you can't take care of your soul if you don't understand what it is. So what I want to do for the next several moments is to actually talk through what Dallas calls the various dimensions of your life, of what it means to be a person, and what they have to be like if they're going to be transformed. And I just want to ask you to kind of walk through this, because you can't care for anything. Like with a car, you can't care for it if you don't know, what's a carburetor doing? What's a transmission do? I have no idea, but some of you know, and so you can care for a car. A lot of people have no idea, what are the parts of a person, and how do they work so that spiritual growth can be a source of life to you and not frustration. So this is very important. Understand, what are the core parts of a person in biblical language? And that's what I want to walk through right now. At the core of you, at the absolute center, is what is called your will. You have the capacity to choose. You are free, in a very limited way, to be able to say yes or to be able to say no. Okay, this is core to you. A couple other words at this point. Dallas is saying the ancient world, the word spirit refers to this same function. The power to say yes or no. Spirit emphasizes the fact that it's personal. It's not a power like gravity or something. And then another word that refers to this is your heart. When the word heart is used in the Bible, it's talking about this core part of you and emphasizing that it's right at the center of you. It's at your heart. So your will, you can say yes or no. This is what makes you you. This is what is so prized and precious about a human being and makes you an individual. When our oldest daughter, Laura, was born, I held that little baby in my hands, had the most amazing experience I didn't anticipate. It was like her entire existence flashed before my eyes. I could see the whole thing. And I said to Nancy, laying there in that hospital bed, this is so amazing to me. I look at this little baby and that little strip of red hair. Laura had like this little mohawk of red hair on her head. One day that's going to turn gray and then it's going to turn white. And this skin that I'm holding, that's so smooth and pink right now, it's going to get all wrinkled and mottled. And this little body that's so pink and pliable and bendable right now is going to get bent and stiff with age. And then we're going to grow old and we'll die and we'll be gone. And then she's going to grow old and she'll die and she'll be gone. And Nancy said, let me hold the baby. You're creeping her out. But see, what makes human beings different than any other object? At its core is you have this will that makes you you. You can choose. And we marvel when a little baby discovers this. When somebody's 2 years old, what's their absolute favorite word? No. Well, they're learning they got a will. They love having a will. What's their second favorite word? Mine. See, that's a word. They're learning all about their will. Okay, the will is real important. It's real limited. We'll get into this. A huge problem in spiritual life is people try to make their wills do things that God did not create your will to do. Your will was created to surrender to God. The will is created to surrender to God. Now, if my will is working right, then it will be fully surrendered to God. And I will always choose what is good, and I will always do what I choose. If my will, but of course, my will's not working right. To live like Jesus, for my soul to be well, for it to be well with my soul, my will must be continually surrendered to God. Okay? Next layer out, you have a mind. And now your will is actually a part of your mind. That's why the outer circles each contain what's within them. So your mind, in biblical language or in the ancient world, referred to both your thoughts, but also your feelings. Okay, my thoughts and my feelings are what the Bible's talking about when it talks about your mind, because every thought has a little emotional charge attached to it. And that's terribly important. Now, if your mind was working the way that it ought to work, it would only think thoughts that are true and noble, and only desires that are right and good. But the reality of our minds is our minds are a mess. This one tiny illustration of this, but you all know about this all the time. And of course, part of what happens is we're not even aware of what's going on in our minds most of the time. I was going through my wallet while I go on. I noticed my credit card was gone. And then I remembered I had given it to my son, Johnny, and he had never given it back to me. And so in my mind, I start thinking all these dark thoughts. What's the matter with him? Why can't he be responsible like I'm responsible? And then I start blaming and I get all self-righteous. All of this is going on in my mind. And so I text him, "Do you still have my credit card?" And he texts back, "Yes." And when he did, I remembered that the reason that he had it was I had given it to him to run an errand for me. And he had not yet had it long enough to be able to run that errand. So all of a sudden, my mind thinks a whole lot of other thoughts about, now, how can I justify myself and make myself look better? So I send Johnny another text just saying, "I miss it." And Johnny sent me a text back saying, "I will help you to forget it." Okay, now, our minds are filled with misguided notions, with false ideas, with wrong desires. Our minds are so jumped up, and mostly we're not even aware of this. And if our minds aren't working right, our behavior will never be right. Your will is not able to overpower a habitually misguided mind. And this is exactly what Jesus gets to when he says, if the inside of a tree is unhealthy, that is, if you're filled with misguided thoughts and wrong desires, then the fruit will never be good. Then your behavior will not be good, okay? So that's the mind. And if I'm going to live like Jesus with a healthy soul, my mind must be transformed to think what's true and to want what's good. Then I have a body. Now, this is super important to your spiritual formation. Very often underestimated or misunderstood by people. The reason that your body is incredibly important is, in biblical language, it's your little kingdom. We're all meant to exercise dominion, to have kingdoms. Your body is the primary and first place in the universe that your will reigns. And we marvel at this with a little infant as they learn that their will can say to their hand or their feet, "Move," and it does. So that's our body. Your body is your little power pack given to you by God so that you can have an existence. But now my body is also full of all kinds of appetites and all kinds of habits. And a lot of times my body, instead of obeying my will, see, the way that God made us was to have wills that are constantly surrendered to him so that our wills could guide our minds and say, "I'll just think what's true and want what's good." And our minds, of course, then would direct our bodies to live in that way. But instead of that, our wills become enslaved by sin, our minds are habitually deluded and misguided, and our bodies become full of toxic habits and enslaving appetites. And this goes on all the time. And a lot of you are wrestling with this right now because you want to stay awake for this message. Your will is saying, "Stay awake for this message." What's your body saying? "I want to go to sleep." And some of you are sleeping. I'm watching you right now. You're making my mind feel bad. And then my body starts to perspire and my mouth gets dry. And so, see, this is all interrelated. Okay, the next circle out, also terribly important. There is a social dimension to you. You live with a relational identity in a relational context. This is who I am. I am somebody's son. I'm somebody's brother. I'm somebody's husband. I'm somebody's father. And all those relationships and all those voices go way down deep inside me. And we were made to live in that community. That's why this is Willow Creek Community Church. And apart from community, you will wither so quickly. A guy named Robert Putnam's done a lot of research on this. He says, just at the physical level, just your body, if you make no other changes this year other than one, if you're not in a small group right now and you join a small group, you cut your odds of dying in the next year in half. That's why at our church, the motto of our small group ministries is, join a small group or die. And you can use that here at Willow Creek. That's available as a, you know, kind of a catchy little motto. Now, each part of the person is incredibly important, and it's so important that you understand how they work together. And the limitations, for example, of the will or the heart or the spirit. Jesus was talking about just this idea about the way that the body, the flesh, gets tired with his disciples one time because he wanted them to pray, but they couldn't do it. Some of you will remember his statement to them. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. See, it's exactly what he's talking about. And they were trying to overpower weak flesh with spirit. It's willing, but it doesn't work. The body needs to be retrained if I'm going to live like Jesus. And that brings us to this amazing dimension of your existence. You have a soul. Now, in the ancient world, thinkers would look at a living creature and how it has a variety of functions. With people, we got wills, we got minds, thoughts, and feelings, we got bodies, social relationships, and so we have all these different functions, and yet we're a single person, we're a single being. And they said this capacity to integrate different functions into one whole life, they called soul. Okay, this is very important. Dallas writes about this quite a lot. The soul is not this vague, diffuse. So many people in the church hear the word, think they understand it. Really interesting. A guy by the name of Jeffrey Boyd, psychiatric researcher, has done a lot of research on this. He actually finds that most people who attend churches subscribe to what he calls the Looney Tunes theory of the soul. Anybody ever see those old Looney Tunes cartoons where Daffy Duck gets shot and his body's on the ground, but then this thin, wispy, little vapory Daffy Duck rises up into the air? And Boyd found most people, when they think about the soul, they just have this general idea of it's this little vapor that lives on after you die. Okay, that's not the soul, because of course, after you die, your will live on, and your mind will live on, and your body will be resurrected, and so. Okay, the soul is that which integrates your will, your intentions, and your mind, all of your thoughts and your feelings and so on, and your body with all of its habits and appetites and behavior and your relationships into one single being. And your soul was made for you to be harmonious, for you to be connected, for you to be at peace, for you to be one within yourself and with other people and with creation. And your soul connects you to God. Your soul is vast. Your soul is the deepest part of you. This is why in the Bible, often the soul will be addressed as if it was another person. Why are you so downcast, O my soul, the psalmist says. Or bless the Lord, O my soul. Now, this is never done with other parts of the person, never the will or the mind, but with the soul it is. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me that is meant to work together in harmony and unity and wonder, goodness. There's a depth to your soul. Now, this is you. When Nancy and I got married, it was in California. She's a California girl, but I wanted to bring joy to her soul. So I took her for our honeymoon to Wisconsin. This did not bring joy to her soul. So I saved up for several decades, and on one of our big anniversaries, I actually took her to Australia. And we actually went snorkeling on the Great Barrier Reef. And it's an amazing experience. One moment you're snorkeling over the reef in a few feet of water. You could literally stand up on it, and then you swim over the edge, and it's like going over the cliff, and there's this bottomless abyss. And Nancy is normally an adventuresome person, but it actually frightened her. And she wanted to get back in the boat. No, I said, I've been saving up for 20 years to take you here because you didn't like Wisconsin. You will not get back in the boat. You will go over the abyss. And she got back in the boat. So for our next anniversary, I'm taking her to Wisconsin. Now, the soul is as deep as eternity. When Job says in the book of Job, I speak out of the bitterness of my soul. See, this is what he's talking about. About 20 times in the Bible, actually, it talks about the soul of God. I love you with my soul, God says. Now, that's talking about the deep, deep place of God. In order to live like Jesus, my soul must be saved. This is such important language. It gets so trivialized in our world. My soul must be saved. What must the soul be saved from? It must be saved from sin. Because sin enslaves the will. So instead of it being freely surrendered to God from one moment to the next, it gets all captured by all kinds of wrong desires and false, misguided beliefs. Soul deludes the mind. Soul corrupts the body. So this is part of the fallen condition. When sin is reigning, the body ends up enslaving the will rather than being directed by the will. And then all my relationships with other people get messed up. And as all of this is going on, your soul is being disintegrated. And this is terribly serious. And the biblical language talks about this. The Greek word for soul, the Bible word is psuche. We get our word psychology from that. James says, it's often translated, the double-minded person is unstable. But literally, he uses the word for soul. The split soul, the person whose parts have been divided and damaged by sin. Or James says, wash your hands, you sinners, purify your hearts, you double-minded. See, there's so much language around this. You remember when Jesus is asked, what's the great command? What he says is, love the Lord your God with all your heart, your mind, your strength, that's your body, and your soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. See, that's not accidental. Jesus knew about persons. And we were made to love God with all of our wills, always to be surrendered to Him, and all of our minds, for every thought to be saturated with God, every desire to be directed by God, for our bodies to just live at peace under God, for our relationships to be guarded by God. See, that's what we were made to do. Now, our problem is that we don't do that, that sin has disintegrated us at every level. And we talk about this in such interesting ways. People will say things like, I feel like my life is falling apart, or I can't hold it together, or I'm coming apart at the seams. That's the cry of the soul, because this has all been disintegrated. Been reading a really interesting book by a guy named Dan Ariely, a Duke professor, called The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. And it's not a biblical book. It's written from a secular perspective, but it actually documents the disintegration of the parts of the person. He summarizes reams of research about how widespread people's tendency is towards cheating, towards self-deceit, self-centeredness, and lying are. His discovery is that we are driven by two primary motivations. One is we want selfish gain. We want it so much that we're willing, under the right conditions, to lie or cheat for it. But then we also want to be able to look at ourselves in the mirror and think well of ourselves. That means we want to view ourselves as honest, honorable people. We idolize ourselves, and then we deny the truth. Now, clearly, these two motives are in conflict. How can we enable our selfishness with deceit, but at the same time view ourselves as wonderful, decent people? He writes, this is where our amazing cognitive flexibility comes into play. Thanks to this human skill, as long as we cheat by only a little bit, we can benefit from cheating and still view ourselves as marvelous human beings. Now, what he calls our amazing cognitive flexibility, the Apostle Paul calls the godlessness and wickedness of human beings who suppress the truth by their wickedness. This is so interesting. Suppress the truth. At some deep level, our will causes our mind to forget, to not look at, to not remember, to not know what we know. And then the soul dies. One tiny example of how this happens. But now see, this is language that we've lost, but it's terribly important for spiritual formation and the healing of the soul. One tiny example of our willingness to lie. Aureli says, over the course of many years of teaching, I've noticed there typically seems to be a rash of deaths among students' relatives at the end of the semester. And it happens mostly in the week before final exams and before papers are due. Guess which relative it is that most often dies? I'm not making this up. Mike Adams, professor at Eastern Connecticut State University, has shown grandmothers are 10 times more likely to die before a midterm and 19 times more likely to die before a final exam. Worse, grandmothers of students who are not doing well in class are at even higher risk. Students who are failing are 50 times more likely to lose poor grandma than non-failing students. The greatest predictor of mortality in the United States among senior citizens ends up being their grandchildren's GPA. And the moral of all this is, if you're a grandparent, don't let your grandchild go to college. It'll kill you. Now, because of the way that the soul works, because we're made for there to be unity for all the parts of the person, a single act of dishonesty is not an isolated event. It shapes how we view ourselves. Now, this goes on in the mind and gets embedded in our neurons. Okay, this is part of why the mind and the body are so closely connected, and it's part of why the mind can't be directed easily by the will, because you get neurons in your body that just habitually run in the same way. And every time I sin causes the greater likelihood of another sin. Start as small as you want. Stand in the express lane with too many groceries. You don't do that, do you? Try to board a plane when it's not my group's turn. And seriously, it makes it a little bit more likely, just a little bit more likely, that someone will cheat on an expense account. Because they say, I'm the kind of person who does something like that, but of course I'm a good person, so it must be okay. It makes it a little more likely that you'll fudge a resume. It makes it a little more likely that you'll say to somebody, it was the traffic when it wasn't the traffic. Or, I sent that email when I didn't send that email. And then over time, homes, workplaces become filled with gossip, cynicism, judgmentalism, racism, people exaggerating their contributions, jealousy. Just enough so we can still feel good about ourselves, see? Very interesting. Sometimes wrongdoing increases so much that it can't be rationalized anymore. When that happens, Aureli says, the common response is not repentance. It's not moral sanity and the seeking of atonement and forgiveness. It's kind of like on a diet. If somebody blows their diet a lot, their mind, this goes on in their mind, their body says, I want, the will gives in. What the mind says is, well, I've already blown it, so I might as well binge now. And similarly, cheating or dishonesty, when rationalizing ceases to be an option, behavior will then completely collapse. And you see this sometimes in scandal-ridden companies, Enron or the Madoff funds. You see it in abusive families. You see it in the nightmare of molestation or abuse. Might as well give in wholly to my urges, gratify whatever I want regardless of the consequences. Then the body is on the throne. Paul talks in Philippians about people whose stomach is their God. God's just talking exactly about this. Then what my body wants, looking good and feeling good, is what I am living for. And then my will is enslaved for this, because of course that can never be enough. There'll never be enough that way. And then my mind is constantly thinking, how can I get all of that? And how can I do that where I can still rationalize it and think of myself as a good person and deceive myself and others? That's why Peter says, "Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world to abstain from sinful desires." Now, sinful desires often have a toehold in our body. My body craves for this, and they become obsessions in my mind, and over time, they overpower my will. And now it's going to take the wise offering of all of the parts of me to God to be transformed. And again, that's why Bible language is so clear about this. Paul says, Romans 12, "Therefore, in view of God's mercies, I urge you," urge is an appeal to the will, "I urge you, offer your bodies as a living sacrifice." Okay, allow your body to do those things which can help it to be retrained by the power of God. Cause the words of Scripture to pass before it. Get enough rest. Bring it into fellowship. "I urge you by God's will, offer your body." See, this language means stuff, guys. "Offer your bodies as living sacrifice. Do not be conformed to the world." That's just this right here. That's what everybody's saying all around you. "Do not be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." Okay? And then all of a sudden, the parts of you begin to work as God intended them to be. And your mind is transformed. And the will is able to give direction. And the body becomes the servant, not the master. And the soul is healed. Peter says, "Dear friends, I urge you, aliens, strangers in the world, I urge you as aliens in the world, to abstain from sinful desires which wage war in your soul." Sin will kill your soul. And what happens in sin is I gossip about stuff, but then in my mind I rationalize it's okay, I justify it. So now my mind is divided against itself. And it takes energy to keep my mind from seeing, to keep me forgetting what I don't want to remember. And my will is at work in all of this, and I begin to be exhausted by this. And I want stuff that can never satisfy my body because my body will keep craving more and more. So I'm at the mercy now of insatiable desires, but I can't let myself think that I'm that kind of person. And so that takes more energy. And then you get in my way. You become my obstacle for what I want. So I resent you. I want to get after you. But of course, I can't let you see that this is what I want from you. So now I have to teach my face to lie to you. And I have to, when I'm talking to you and looking at you, I have to make you think I really like you. And so the will teach my body to do this. And it's exhausting. And this is why so often things like first dates or job interviews, things where we're working hard to impress other people, doing impression management, why we're so tired, it just exhausts the will to do this. And we weren't made for this. I love this. Dallas used to say about little children, one of the reasons we love a little child is they have not learned to manage their face. You just look at their face and you know when you look at their face what's going on in their mind and what's going on in their will. And that's a precious thing, see. Because then you don't have to guess or wonder or live as a victim at the mercy of someone who is using their face to conceal their mind and their wills. And then we grow up and we learn to manage our faces, and we call it growing up, but the Bible calls it death. And then, to use the own language of Paul, there is sin in your members. That's in your body at the deep habitual level. This is the ruined soul. This is the lost soul. This language needs to be understood again because Jesus knows. And things like lost souls or saving souls have become such cliches in our day. Jesus was a prophet, a person to gain the whole world and lose their soul. And for so long, I didn't understand that. I thought what that meant was it doesn't do you any good to have a lot of money or a lot of pleasure or, you know, a lot of success, which, of course, would be great things to have, but if you're going to end up in hell, it doesn't do you any good to get that stuff. That's not what he's saying. Of course, it's true, but that's not his point. What Jesus is doing is diagnosing the real human condition for the ruined soul, where the will has become utterly enslaved and just captive, and the mind is constantly obsessed with, I gotta have this, I want this, but I have to fool myself into thinking I'm better than I really am. And the body is on the throne, and it's this cluster of habits and appetites that are in charge and ruling and demeaning, and relationships get all messed up. For that soul, you can go ahead and get the whole world. It won't even bring you lasting satisfaction, let alone goodness before God. And you don't have to believe Jesus to get this. Just look around. Look at Bernie Madoff. Look at Amy Winehouse. Look at me. Look at you. We live on a planet of lost souls, and nobody knows. And we take better care of our cars or our pension funds, for crying out loud. Only one power can save a soul. And there's only one way it happens. And there are words that the human race can never escape. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. That is, I shall not live as a victim of unsatisfied desires, always gnawing at my will and obsessing my mind and reigning in my body. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. I want a restored soul. And so Jesus, this matchless man, this carpenter, strides out of the human scene and issues an invitation. He issues it still. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened. See, sin exhausts the human being. And I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For I am gentle and humble in heart. And you will find rest for your souls. Because if you come in and learn from me and allow me to come into you, then you'll start to live with a surrendered will. And a transformed mind that thinks about what is true and desires what is good, and a body whose habits and appetites come under the direction of God, and relationships that get to be redeemed and transformed by love. And that's the only way. That's the only way a soul can find rest, not by gaining the world, not by getting more money and more stuff, and, you know, things that just end up corrupting you all through here. That's not the way. Just stupid. Only one man. Only one way. And you all know what that way is. I'll give you a little picture of this. Nancy and I, when we went back to California, one of the things that we did was we actually took dance lessons. Nancy grew up in California, grew up very graceful, a great dancer just by nature. Not me. I grew up in Rockford, Illinois. Not the dance capital of the world. I grew up in a Baptist church and a Swedish family, and so I never danced. I knew Jesus didn't dance. I just never did it. But we went back to California, and I actually thought it'd be kind of fun. So we actually took some dance classes. I knew I'd be no good at it. The owner of the studio came over because he could see real fast we were having big problems, and I knew it would be me. But he didn't actually talk to me. He talked to my wife. And he said to her, now, Mrs. Ortberg, you have to understand, for the dance to work, for it to have grace, for it to have beauty, for it to come alive, there's a real important dynamic, and you're having a problem with this. Somebody in the dance, somebody has to lead, and somebody has to follow. There's got to be that way. Someone's got to lead, someone's got to follow. So he said, Mrs. Ortberg, I just want to ask you, when you're dancing with your husband, who's leading? She was very quiet, and she said to slightly gritted teeth, he's leading. And then the owner of the studio said, and who's following? More gritted teeth. I'm following. Now, I didn't say a word. But I enjoyed it immensely. I asked him, you know, could you come to our home every once in a while and we could just keep going over this? I think that'd be good. This Willow Creek, you understand, fully devoted followers, you understand, Jesus leads, I follow, I humble myself, I confess, I submit, I surrender, all the parts of me so that my soul can be saved. So guys, how about it? Right now. How about your will? Is there any area where you have been clinging in your will to disobedience to God? My ego, my pride, money gets a hold of the will. Oh my goodness, maybe it's your money and you've been kind of clutching on it. You haven't been giving to God, and yet you want to think of yourself as a generous person, and it's disintegrating your soul. How about your mind? You need to surrender your mind fully to Jesus today. Let him lead in your mind. Are there any misguided desires? Any thoughts that just keep coming around and you say, God, I have to give those to you. How are you feeding your mind? Guys, when Paul says, don't be conformed to this world, we live in a world where people feed their minds trash. And I don't just mean sexually, although God knows that's an area where so many of our minds need to be fed better stuff, but just thoughts that are noble and pure, right, true, and good, honorable. And we treat our minds, you know, we just feed them trash. Maybe you got to get serious today about how you will care for and feed your mind so that it can think what is true and noble and want what is good. How about your body? Any habits? Any appetites running rampant? Is your mouth saying words that a mouth shouldn't say? Are your feet going places where feet shouldn't go? Are your eyes looking at stuff where eyes shouldn't look? Paul says, submit your bodies, a living sacrifice. Maybe that's the deal. How about your relationships? Been holding on to resentment? Have you been deceiving somebody? Are you in a relationship that would dishonor God and you need to stop it today? See, the will can choose to do that. Will you surrender? Will, mind, body, relationships today fully as God helps you to Jesus so that your soul can be saved, rescued, delivered, redeemed, healed, at rest. The greatest miracle in the universe is still the miracle of a saved soul. 2,000 years ago, that is why Jesus came to this earth. That's why he died on a cross. That's why he was raised again. 40 years ago, that's why Willow Creek Community Church began, so that it could be part of saving souls. Of all the works of God, the work that God loves the most, that causes all of heaven to break out in triumphant rejoicing, the one for which God paid the highest price, the price of a blood-stained cross and an empty tomb, is the salvation of a human soul. And I will tell you a little secret, he's not done yet. God bless you so much.